All right, we have to start with this. I owe an apology to all my Canadian listeners. I'm terribly sorry. Last week, I screwed up. I said something that I didn't actually mean to say. I referred to Canada as a state. And this is a terrible time to do that. And I don't think of Canada that way, but I was comparing driving across Texas to driving across Canada, and I called Canada a big, beautiful state, and that was terrible. I edited that part out of the podcast, so you may not have even heard it, but for those of you who did, I offer my most sincere apology. My only explanation is that I flubbed my words because I was talking about states at the time. I promise you, I absolutely do not think of Canada anything other than the big, beautiful, strong, sovereign country that it is and should always be. So please forgive me, and I hope you know me well enough to know that I wouldn't do anything like that intentionally. Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 249, and we're going to talk about everybody's favorite controversial topic. No, not insulation. Leave no trace. Is it realistic? Can you follow these principles? We'll talk about it. We're also going to talk about trackers. You know those things you hide in your van so you can find who stole it? We've got some things to say about that. We're also going to do a product review of something, well, there's a story behind it, and other stuff too. Hey, you're going to listen anyway, right? So we'll just skip that. It has been a day. I'm doing this late, and I apologize for that. I'm a little overwhelmed by world events at the moment, and if you are too, I understand. And I don't know what to do yet, but understand that I understand what you're going through, whatever it might be. We are apparently at the dawn of either a golden age or an age of lots of strife. But there's lots of changes coming, and some of them are pretty heavy. That said, we do have a podcast to do, and so that's what we're going to do. Folks, leave no trace, leave no trace. There's 7 principles of leave no trace. If you've done any kind of research into van life at all, you have probably run into leave no trace. It actually did not originate with van life. It's mostly a camping set of guidelines, but it is absolutely adopted by most van lifers, and it's almost kind of assumed that van lifers will follow the 7 principles of leave no trace. And in the Discord channel that we have, which is Built to Go, a Discord server, because I'm not very creative, which you can find at builttogo.com, up in the top, there's a link there if you'd like to join us. We had a nice discussion about leave no trace, which was inspired by Big Rob of Big Rob's Van, which is a YouTube channel you should definitely check out. And I thought I would share my thoughts, and you get to make up your own mind in the end. But first, we have to start with, well, what the heck are the 7 principles? Now, I found several different versions of these principles, but they all boil down to the same thing. And the one on the REI website seemed to be the most simple. It had the fewest words, basically. So I thought we would go with that. So the principles are, in order, which I don't think matters at all. Number 1, plan ahead and prepare. So the concept here is, you know, don't just go blundering into the wilderness thinking that you're going to find a place to stay. Do some prep, you know. There are not subtle things you can encounter out there, and if you don't have a plan, you can actually do damage to the environment. Because ultimately, folks, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about not damaging the environment. Go out, have a great time, enjoy everything, but leave no trace that you were there. That's kind of the point. And planning is absolutely part of that. How do you get in? How do you get out? Is there firewood there? Can you use it? Or is it a no-burn spot? I mean, you need to know all that stuff, or you can cause a lot of harm. And I'm going to fess up to something I did that was terrible. I've actually talked about it before, but on my second trip to Aurora, Nevada, I took a wrong turn. Now, I didn't do as much research the second time because I'd already been there. I knew the way, except somehow I got all twisted up, I got lost, and I ended up driving through an historic cemetery, like between the headstones. Terrible. Absolutely not something I would ever plan to do, and I didn't realize I was doing it until it was too late because it's the cemetery of the ghost town. Terrible. I feel really, really bad about it. And first thing I did was I stopped the van and looked around and found the quickest way out of there. I actually had to move some rocks, not headstones, had to move some rocks to get out of there. And I did, and I found the main road, but I should have planned better. I should have known the route better. I should have had a better map, and I should have gone more slowly and not gone until I knew exactly where I was. That's on me, and that's the kind of thing that can happen if you don't follow principle number one. So, okay, that's principle number one. Principle number two, similar, travel and camp on durable surfaces. Now, what does that mean, durable surfaces? Basically, this means don't camp in mud. Don't camp in places where you're going to leave tire tracks that last for centuries, because that is absolutely possible in some places. You can still find tracks from the Oregon Trail out there. Those settlers and pioneers just didn't follow leave no trace principles. Well, no, they didn't. They were trying to survive. They weren't actually worrying about leave no trace. They were trying to get to where they were going. Without dying of dysentery, of course. By the way, there was an outbreak of dysentery in Oregon this week, which is a little ironic, but however, I'm off track here. Anyway, yeah, no, seriously, don't park in places where you're going to cause damage for the van life people. Don't put your tent in places that are going to cause damage. And out west, this goes back to planning. Some of those places aren't obvious, because you might think, well, I'm just going to go out here in the desert, you know, who really cares? But you need to know what cryptogamic soil is before you do that. You could be killing an organism hundreds of years old if you don't know what you're doing. Definitely look up cryptogamic soil if you're going to do any kind of camping in the desert southwest of the United States, and stay away from it. Leave it alone. This stuff is older than you, and you will die, and it will still be alive unless you drive on it. And yeah, don't do that. So, very obvious principle there. Okay, number three, dispose of waste properly. Okay, this is the one that people get in trouble with. What is waste? Waste is something that you don't want. That's it. That's all waste is. That includes bodily wastes, whether they be solid or liquid. It includes trash. It includes smoke from your fire, exhaust from your tailpipe, oil dripping from your engine, any of those things. And this is the thing of all the seven principles that's probably going to be the one that causes the most problem. Now, almost everybody's going to agree you shouldn't just throw your bag of trash out the van and hit the road. Yeah, people do that, though. We all know people do that. We've all pulled into the campsite and just seen it completely trashed. We are not those people. If you are one of those people, you have my invitation to stop this podcast right now and go listen to something else. But I'm assuming you're not one of those people. And the trick is, where are the lines? And the lines, for me, are based on a lot of factors. Going down the list here, what do you do with your trash? Well, you take your trash with you. That's an easy one. Just take your trash with you. Anything you bring, you take with you. You leave no trace. You leave nothing behind. So cans, plastic, anything like that, you're definitely going to take with you. That is without question. What about things you can burn? All right. Little bit trickier here, right? Like you've got some cardboard and some wood and even maybe some food scraps, you know. You don't want to leave the food scraps in the van for a bunch of reasons, so what do you do with those? And you're allowed to have a campfire here, so what if you just burned those? Well, gray area, a little bit. In my opinion, if you're allowed to have a fire there and you're not in like an urban environment or something, yeah, it's okay to do that, in my opinion. People will disagree. In Tiki Bago land, where I've got 4 acres by the river that's surrounded by 50 acres of woods, I burn stuff fairly often. We don't have trash pickup there. I take all the real trash items back to Chicago and dispose of them there. But it's bulky. And cardboard, if you live in modern society, you know, cardboard just kind of multiplies. Yeah, I will burn cardboard and things like that on that property. There's a big fire ring. I do it as safely as I can. There's no risk of forest fires there. It's just too wet. So I'm okay in that situation. But if I were in Colorado in a dry kind of forest, no. I'm not lighting a fire there. Absolutely not. Okay, well, that's solid goods. What about waste? Well, what do bears do? Why can't we do what bears do? Oh, that varies all over the place. If you're hiking through the woods by yourself, yeah, there are ways to do what bears do completely ethically, or at least as ethically as possible. Some people will say that in very sensitive areas, you should pack that out too, and they have bags for that. Unfortunately, the name of one of those bags is a wag bag. Yeah, it's a bag that you kind of tape to your butt, and then you make a little squatting gesture, and you can figure out the rest. Yeah, my name is associated with a lot of cool things. But, in some places you will do that. It's context sensitive. In other places, it's fine to go off the trail a bit, dig a cat hole 6 inches deep, and do your business. And then there's debate over whether you can put the toilet paper in there or not. Some people say yes. It used to be that you should burn the toilet paper, but now the thought is that burning things is actually more risky, so you shouldn't do that. It gets complicated. So back to step number one, plan ahead and prepare. Find out what is acceptable there. Okay, black water. If you've got black water from a cassette toilet or from a holding tank in your rig, dispose of that properly. That is raw sewage. Don't just dump that in the woods. Take it somewhere safe. A cassette toilet's perfectly fine to use a toilet for that. That's what toilets are for. It's fine. Sometimes a port-a-john is fine, as long as you're not, invading somebody's private space that they have to pay to pump out, that kind of thing. But that's fine. Know that if you have a toileting system that has a black water tank, you're responsible for disposing that properly. Composting toilets. Composting toilets. The stuff they produce is not compost. I've said this a few times. I still see people saying that, it composts in 6 hours. No, it doesn't. That is not compost. It is pre-compost. It is material that you can compost, but that takes about a year. So for all intents and purposes, that stuff should be treated just like black water. Now, unlike black water, it's fairly easy to bag, and then you can just throw it in the trash, right? Oh, well, people are mixed on that opinion, too. On the one side, you've got it's no different than dog waste or diapers. And on the other side, you have you're throwing human waste into a trash bag, and someone's going to have to pick up that trash bag and deal with it. What do I think? I go back and forth on this all the time, honestly, but I think in small quantities, it is fine to use the trash can for that, so long as you have packaged it really well. As for dumping it in the woods, no, I think it's too much. The problem with a lot of these things isn't that you're doing them, it's the quantity, it's how much. And imagine if you're at a van camping event and there's 20 vans and they all have composting toilets, and they all dump it in the woods, that's a lot, and that is going to affect the ecosystem and pleasantness of the area, so I don't think you should do that. So, in Tiki Bago Land, I do have a composting toilet. I haven't actually hooked it up yet, but I will create a compost pit for that. It will be managed the way a compost pit should be managed, and that will be fine. That is a completely reasonable option. Gray water, or, human liquids, as well as human liquids. I treat them the same, honestly. I think they have the same risk factor. So urine and gray water, I kind of treat the same. You don't want to drink it, but it's not that big of a deal, except gray water actually can be. There is an argument that gray water can be just as bad as black water. Well, but so what, right? You wash your hands in the sink and you wash some dishes and you've got a couple gallons of gray water. Why not just let it out on the ground? Well, again, context. Depending on where you are, that might actually be okay. And you have to decide for yourself. So if you're, let's say you're in a rest stop and there's a drain there, well, it seems convenient, right? But then you look at the drain and it says drains directly into river. And you think, oh, that's okay, I'm using biodegradable soap. Yeah, no, it's not okay. The biodegradable part is nice, but that doesn't prevent it from being soap. Soap is bad for ecosystems, and if that soap gets in the river, you're going to be messing things up. Yeah, okay, just 1 gallon, maybe not so bad, but 20 gallon. Anyway, you see the point. It ramps up very quickly. So you do have to think about these things. For me, Tiki Bago Land, land that I own, industrial land that has been messed up and is starting to get back to nature, I don't have a problem with releasing gray water there. But that's my land, my choice, and I have actually considered the impact. The rest of these are fairly simple, so we can go through them quickly. Number 4, leave what you find. Yeah, I like collecting seashells. I'm sure you do too. Leaves are fun and stuff. But the principle is you don't take anything. You just don't take anything that's out there. You just leave it alone so other people can enjoy it. Obviously, there are things about this that make sense and don't. For example, what is the harm in taking a leaf? That leaf is just going to rot, you know, whatever. And I would agree, there is no harm. However, I will tell you a very quick story. There was a place in Vermont called Button Bay, and the clay dried around these reeds and hardened into these little discs that had holes in them, and they looked like buttons. And you could go along the shore, and there were these little buttons you would find, and it was very cool. And then in the 50s, the Girl Scouts had a big jamboree there, and someone told the Girl Scouts, hey, girls, go down there. They have these little button things. And yeah, there's no more buttons in Button Bay. They cleaned it out. They took them all. So that's an extreme. Although I've heard stories of girls going back and throwing them back in the water, which is kind of cool. But anyway, that's an extreme, but you know, sometimes to illustrate points, you have to do an extreme. Number five, minimize campfire impacts. Be careful with fire. That one's pretty obvious. Yeah, do that. Number six, respect wildlife. Don't be torturing the animals. You know that. But also, don't be feeding the animals. That's a huge problem. The expression is, a fed bear is a dead bear. Yeah. Animals are not your friends. I have a friend, Susie, who absolutely loves wildlife, and it's kind of weird. It's like Snow White. They come out of the woods and like jump on her shoulder and whisper in her ear, and it's freaky. But don't actually be like that. I mean, sorry, Susie, if you ever happen to listen to this, but as far as the Leave No Trace principles are concerned, that is bad behavior. And I know you would never do anything to hurt those little squirrels. And number seven, and a very important one, be considerate of other visitors. Don't be the person who leaves a campsite in such a state that the next person comes in and says, God, what a slob stayed here. And also, this isn't a principle, but I think a lot of people add this on. Do what you can to pick up after those people. I always do this. If I go into a campsite, I will, first thing to do, take a trash bag and go around and pick up all the trash I see laying around and take as much as I can. I mean, that's just what I do. Now, I've already talked about this now for 15 minutes or so, been long enough, but there's a major point in all of this, and that is that these rules are more like guidelines. They're very important, in my opinion, but how you apply them is actually a personal decision. The important thing is that you care. That's the important thing. Read the guidelines, absorb them, and then care about them. And while people might disagree with your decisions here and there, in general, you will be doing your best to have the least impact possible on the environment, and you can go out there and enjoy stuff, knowing that other people can come enjoy it after you, and that if no people come at all, it's fine, because nature can still do its thing. So that's the bottom line of Leave No Trace. A very short way of saying that is care. That's it. Special thanks to Jessica for helping to support Built2Go. She went to buymeacoffee.com/built2go and bought me some diesel. And because of that, there are no ads in this episode, and I am thrilled with that. Thank you, Jessica, and thank you to everyone who donates every month. If you would like to help support the show and avoid ads on the show, please visit buymeacoffee.com/built2go, and you can buy me a gallon of diesel, and that will mean no ads. Thank you very much. Van Life News. Okay, the big news is that tariffs are changing everything, and they come and they go, and nobody knows anything, and obviously, I am not going to be your source for information on tariffs. So, good luck, guys. I don't know what's going on. I don't think anybody does. So I've just picked three other stories here, and I'm kind of ignoring the really big story, but I'm sorry. I mean, that's the way it is. The first one, though, is related. Canadian snowbirds face border hurdles. Now, it used to be that Canadians could come down to the U.S. and stay for 90 days and head back, and there'd be no problem. That changed recently, and I'm not sure everybody knows about this. Be sure you read the article in the show notes that I will have linked there. It's from Spectrum Local News of New York State, which is a weird source, but there it is. The deal is that because of recent, I'm not sure if it was legislation or executive order or something, recent changes in the federal government of the United States, it's now 30 days. You cross the border, you can only stay for 30 days unless you register somehow. There's some new way to register, and I don't even know what that is. The article might get into it. And if you stay longer than the 30 days, you could get in trouble. And with the way things are now, you don't want to get in trouble. So if you are Canadian planning to come to the U.S., and I know that there are fewer of you than there used to be sure you understand these rules and that it's 30 days without any hassle, but anything longer than that, you actually do need to have paperwork, and then it's a 90-day max, unless you do something fancy like get a work visa or something like that, which would be very difficult. So I'll have a link in the show notes. Canadian snowbirds face border hurdles. Number two, related, there's a crackdown on egg smuggling. Okay, yes, the price of eggs is very expensive, and guess what? It's not Biden's fault. And you know what? It's not Trump's fault either. The president is not dictating the price of eggs. What is dictating the price of eggs? It's the avian flu. Avian flu, whether you've heard about it or not, is a huge problem right now, and it's growing, and it's starting to impact farmers' flocks, and the farmers freak out about this. They don't see chickens as like individual animals like many of us do. They see them as like a crop, and they're afraid that the chickens that are infected with avian flu will affect the whole crop. So what they do is, if there's any hint of avian flu, they kill the whole flock, and I will not tell you how they do that because you might not like it, but they eliminate the whole flock, and that means no eggs. Now, to their thinking, as a business person, they're thinking, well, there goes 6 weeks of production, and then they just get new chicks because chicks are so plentiful, and they grow new ones. But what's happening is that so many farmers have done this is that there's just, right now, not a lot of chickens laying eggs, and therefore there are fewer eggs. Basic economics, supply and demand. You get it. That's why eggs are expensive. And because of that, countries that haven't had the avian flu issues that we have, or maybe haven't detected them, they don't have the egg prices we have. So people have been like driving up from Mexico with cars full of eggs, and somehow that's a no-no. So there's a big crackdown on that. So if you happen to be coming to the U.S. from Canada or Mexico and you have a whole lot of eggs, you might have them taken away from you. Or get some kind of a custom duty or something. Just be aware of that. You're going to be fine with a dozen, but if you have like six dozen, yeah, that would probably not a good idea. And finally, just finishing off with some other good news here. From Australia, some folks had a nice caravan down there, as they call it, and they lost it. It caught fire. They lost $175,000. This article is from Australia, so it's probably $175,000 Australian dollars. But yikes. And it turns out the cause was their lithium batteries. Okay, we know that lithium batteries can sometimes catch fire. They store a lot of energy, and that energy is released in the form of fire, and it's really hard to put out. We know all that. But there's something else to know about, and this is why I'm sharing this story. It's a very important point. There is a big difference between lithium ion and lithium iron phosphate. So lion, if you see like lion, lithium ion, that's what that short's for. That's the older style of lithium batteries. And if you bought, say, a power station circa 2020 or so, you might or probably have that kind of chemistry. Newer ones tend to all be lithium iron phosphate, which you will see as LiFePO4. big difference between those two. LiFePO4 is better in every way. If you ever have the choice, LiFePO4 is better, and prices now, they're almost the same. There's really no reason to ever buy anything lithium ion right now. But one of the main reasons is that lithium ion is much easier to catch fire. It basically starts when something gets damaged. There's a little nick in the case for the battery, and you might not even see it. Maybe you dropped your power station and picked it up and it looked okay, and there's a little scuff, but you didn't think anything of it. Well, then 2 days later, it could burst into flames. And that's sort of what happened to these folks in Australia. So I feel terrible for them. But the lesson from their tragedy is avoid using lithium ion batteries if you can. If you are using lithium ion batteries, make sure they're protected. It would be a very good idea to put them in a metal box if they're inside your van. And if you have an old power station like I do, I've got a couple of old cheap Chinese power stations that I know are lithium ion. I'm going to treat them a little bit differently now. I treat them very roughly because they're just old, beat-up, cheap things, but I'm no longer going to just throw them in the back of my truck. I'm going to make sure they're secured. So, good lesson there. Sorry for the folks in Australia who had to provide it for us, but it's a good thing to know. Tech Talk. I have talked way too much in the first half here, so these other items are going to be a little shorter, and I'm sorry, but I'm not, because that's how it goes. You have probably heard of AirTags. These are Apple AirTags, these little discs. And if you are in the Apple universe, these things are wonderful. I highly recommend that you get some and put them everywhere. Put one in every vehicle you own. Put one in every suitcase, because you can do magic with them. You can find missing things. If someone steals your van, you'll know where they are. Or you can tell that the airline is lying to you because they say, well, sir, I'm sorry, your suitcase didn't get loaded on the plane. And you can look at your phone and see, actually, it's 20 feet behind you. Could you just go get it? And actually, the airlines are starting to integrate with that. So these things are great. They cost $20 to $25 a piece, depending on your deal. And I think everyone should have them. But not everybody is in the Apple universe. So what does Android have to offer? And, well, I am not getting into an Android iOS war, not interested in that at all. I happen to be an Apple guy. If you're using Samsung or whatever, good, don't care. We are not at odds. But an article that was given to me by John from the Discord channel, thank you, John, basically breaks it down. And the bottom line is, there's not a good solution for Android right now. There are a bunch of things you can get, but they don't work anywhere near as well as the Apple ones, unfortunately. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but that's just the reality now. I'm sure someday that will get fixed. One suggestion they have is that, as annoying as it is, if you're an Android person, when you're traveling, try to get an old iPhone. All it needs is Wi-Fi connection. You don't have to have it hooked up, but with that, you could track your luggage. And you could think of it as not an iPhone, but a luggage tracking system. Or your van, or whatever, your kayak, your paddles. I mean, anything. Is this thing's the size, it's the size of like 3/4, maybe a little bigger. Anywhere you can fit that, you can track the thing. And the way it works basically is, if someone comes near it with their phone, it sends a signal through that person's Bluetooth, and it's all passive. They can't turn it off or anything. They don't know what happens. It's all secure and passive. Everybody is transmitting everybody else's Find My data. So anyway, these tracker things are great. But if you're an Android person, make sure you read the article I have linked here from Android Authority, where they basically said, you're going to want to have an AirTag because they're better. Product review. So I have a problem with product reviews because I've been sitting on my ass since January. I haven't walked since January, never mind driven, never mind gone camping or anything, and I haven't had any new experiences with products. And I'm sitting there with my computer on my lap, like, what am I going to review? And then I looked down and I was like, oh, that makes sense. So what I'm going to review is something that I recommend. I like this thing, and it's a lap desk. It's a particular lap desk. So on Amazon right now, I understand Amazon's problematic. What am I going to do? Amazon right now has this thing. It's about $20-$21. It's just a plain old lap desk. And what a lap desk is it's a board with kind of a pillow under it, and you can put it on your lap and you can type on it. And I've been using this for weeks. I am basically stuck in a recliner all day long. And this thing has let me keep up with things. And boy, this is going to be great in the van too. When I'm done with all this and I'm back in the van, I'm bringing the lap desk, because not only can I use it in the van, or if Jen, my wife, is with me in the passenger seat, she can use it with her computer there, but it also makes a desk kind of area. In my van, I've got a big, long couch. And when I'm by myself, I mean, I can sit four on this couch. I'm only taking up one of the spaces. But if I put the lap desk on there, then it's like a little table there. And that's very nice. Or if I want to go outside and sit in the chair, I've got a MacBook Pro. It's pretty heavy. And I can just... Anyway, it's a very basic, simple lap desk. No bells and whistles. Comes in 9 million colors. And for $21, it's definitely worth it. It's much more comfortable than putting your laptop just directly on your lap, especially if you have like a gaming PC. My gaming PC is also a heater. That thing pumps out so much heat that I have to use a lap desk with it. And yes, the savvy amongst you will say, yeah, don't listen to him. Just get yourself a big cutting board. It works just fine. And yeah, that's not wrong. You can use a cutting board. But if you want to have something that's a little bit more adjustable because of the pillow underneath, this thing's great. Link in the show notes, and I'm going to have a hard time finding something for next week. Tales from the Road. Okay, last week I teased a story, and then somebody, a friend of mine, Steve, an excellent author and marketing guru, private messaged me and said, no, you must tell the story. I want to know it now. And so I did tell Steve the story, but I'm going to tell it to you. It's going to be a little different because it's that kind of a story. Anyway, story time, okay? I'm living in Virginia. It's 1999, I think, maybe 1998. And my then wife, not Jen, a different woman, my then wife and I bought a house, big house, in the middle of 9 acres of woods in rural Loudoun County, Virginia. Now, back then, Loudoun County was rural. If you're familiar with the area, there's this thing called the Greenway. It's kind of a highway out there. That wasn't even there. None of the development was there. I basically drove down dirt roads and everything to get to this kind of amazing property. But there were 2 acres of grass on that property, which is a lot, and I had to mow it. And, well, I had enough money to buy this big property back then, thanks to AOL. Thank you, AOL. But mowing, you know, I was like, all right, I'm going to get a ride-on mower. If I'm buying this big house, I'm getting a ride-on mower. So I bought a ride-on mower. Worked out fine. This is not what the story's about. The story is about the fact that ride-on mowers need gasoline. So, all right, I'm go out there to mow. And before I go out there to mow, I'm going to dress appropriately, right? It's summer. In Virginia, it's hot, it's sticky, there's lots of bugs, and the way our yard was set up, there was a lot of dust generated from when I was cutting the grass, so I wanted to wear grubby clothes, and I went upstairs, and, you know, we're kind of low on laundry, and I'm like, all right, whatever, I go into that drawer that everybody has that's full of clothes you never wear, but you don't want to throw out for some reason, and right on top of there is this big white t-shirt. It was actually a gift for my wife years ago, but whatever, who cares, I'm just going out to cut the grass. So I throw that shirt on. And I hop in my Subaru Forester and head down to the general store. And this part of Virginia at that time, it was rural enough that there were general stores. Like, yeah, the old-style general stores. These things had been in business for maybe 100 years. They were nothing like a supermarket. Old wooden floors and stuff on the shelves that hadn't sold in 50 years. Like, literally, like, you know, mercerized thread and stuff. It was fun. I really liked going to these places. The one nearest me was called Church's Store. And that's in Watson, Virginia, if anyone cares to look it up. It's gone now. It doesn't matter. I think the building's still there. Church's Store had a gas pump. This was rare. These were gas pumps that were legacy gas pumps from like the 30s, and this they still had theirs. Their tank hadn't been condemned yet. That happened 2 years later. But anyway, so I go there to get gas. I go in the store, and you know, obviously this little store, they used to have it. You just pumped, and then you had to go to pay, but some people would run it off, so I had to go inside to pay. So I go inside. I grab a soda, and I grab a little thing of candy as kind of like motivation to do this task that's not all that thrilling. And as I grab the stuff and head back to the counter, these 3 other guys come in. It's Saturday. People are out doing stuff. It's fine. They walk by me. I just give them a little nod. I don't know who they are. I mean, I didn't know my neighbors that well. It was rural enough that you didn't see neighbors. And as I approach the counter, the tallest of these 3 men, a gentleman wearing a muscle shirt, a cowboy hat, and the kind of mustache you would wear with a cowboy hat, stops, turns around, and looks at me. And he doesn't say anything, but I'm like, interesting. Okay, so I stop, and I look at him, and as soon as my eyes meet his, he says, I wouldn't wear that. And I'm like, And I look down, I'm like, What I had done was I had grabbed a shirt that belonged to my wife, although I knew she would never wear it. She had said this. She wanted to turn into rags. This was a rag shirt. I did nothing against my wife. It was the shirt. So she had a boss from Texas, and this boss was very, very proud of Texas. And when she went back to Texas, she brought a shirt, a Texas shirt, back for my wife. And while Texas and Virginia are both very proud states, Texas wasn't the issue. What was the issue was what was written on the shirt. And the shirt said, I laughed, I cried, I nearly died, for when I awoke, there was a cowboy by my side. And I said, okay, this shirt. Look, man, it's just my wife's shirt. I'm out cutting the grass. I just grabbed whatever because I'm about to get filthy, that's all. And he looked at me and said, I said I wouldn't be wearing that shirt. And I looked at his hand, because it moved, and it formed into a fist. And I thought to myself, I'm about to be gay bashed. And I'm sad to add this, but again. Okay, I'm teasing another story that I probably won't ever tell. And I'm like, okay. what do I do in this situation? This gentleman is clearly offended that I'm wearing a shirt that hints that I could possibly be gay and that I could be proud enough to go out in public and pronounce to the world, "Hello, gay man here," even though I'm not. And if I was, I just might do something like that. But I wasn't doing something like that. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, I've recently come into a lot of money. I'm pretty new to the neighborhood. I'm not really from here. And I'm thinking, if we have an incident, the two of us, and I defend myself, I am likely to create a story and an impression on the neighbors, who in rural areas you need to depend on to some extent. And I'm opening myself up for a lawsuit. And I thought to myself, neither of those is desirable outcomes. In fact, even if I, by some miracle underdog movie, managed to put this guy in his place, that wasn't going to happen. I would still lose. I was in a lose-lose situation. So I decided right then and there that I was simply going to do nothing. I was going to not offer one bit of resistance. I moved to the counter, put my soda and candy on the counter, made sure the clerk saw me, and then I turned back to the man and just stood there. I didn't say anything. I just kept looking at him, and I kept my hands by my side, and I just waited for what was going to happen. And in my mind, I figured he was going to punch me. I was going to have to take a punch. I would go down on the floor and stay there until they left. Then I would get their license plate number, and the clerk would be my witness. That was my best case scenario. Instead, what actually happened was one of the buddies saw what was going on and kind of walked quickly over, put his hand on this guy's shoulder, and I want to say his name was Dan, and said, "Dan, he's just cutting the grass. It's not worth it. Leave him alone." And the guy said, "Look at that shirt." And his buddy said, "Yeah, I know. He's just cutting the grass. It's not his shirt. He's not saying anything. He's probably not even gay," which was not the word he used. And then he looked at me, released his fist, and went with his friend to the back of the store to buy beer, which I had a feeling they'd already had a few of. And I went to the clerk. He gave me kind of a relieved look, and I bought my things, got my gas, and went back to my house. But I didn't go back to my house directly, because I didn't know if this was actually over. So I went back to my house the long way, thinking that if somebody wanted to follow me and do me some harm, I would rather they did that not at my house, where my wife and 2-year-old kid were, and I also didn't want them to know where my house was. So yeah, probably not the ending that this story would have if it were a Hollywood story, but that's the ending it really had. And I'm pretty happy with the decisions I made there. And, you know, I have an awful lot of respect for folks who are willing to go out in public and be proud of who they are, regardless of what anybody else thinks about it, because this stuff is real. People will punish you for being who you are. Those people are wrong. And if there's ever a time when I see that situation and I'm a third party, I'm not going to be a third party. A place to visit. Welcome to the Hotel California. And you know the song. Everybody knows the song. Whether you love it or hate it, you've heard it 8 million times, especially if you've been around a construction site. However, there is a Hotel California that is the official Hotel California, and it is in California. But it is not in Los Angeles. It's not even in the state of California. It's not even in the United States. It's actually on Baja California, which is where the state of California gets its name. By the way, that is a crazy story. Look up where California got its name. You will not believe it. It is a bizarro story. However, the original one was Baja California, and the original Hotel California is in Baja California, and it has nothing to do with the song at all. The Eagles were actually referring to the Beverly Hills Hilton. We all know that. But there is a Hotel California, and because of the name, it's become a big tourist trap. But what it is it was like the town hotel for this little town, like halfway up Baja California. Now, this is actually in Ciudad Benito Juarez, That's in the Centro. The address is actually fairly complicated, but it doesn't matter. Baja is so skinny. And I know a lot of folks take their vans down to Baja, and a lot of them have probably stopped here. But if you're ever going down to Baja, this is kind of a fun place to stop. It's a Mexican village, a little bit more developed than some, but certainly not touristy like Cozumel or Cabo or anything like that. It's a lot more authentically Mexican. And this hotel, it is a hotel, but it also is, it's a place to eat. Again, it's a little touristy, but when you get in there, there's all these tables. You can get some authentic Mexican food, which is always welcome. And then there's a giant courtyard, and you can actually eat outside too. It's a nice place to be, and it's a nice place to center yourself for a day's exploration, because there's a number of interesting things to see in this town. And there's local tour guides. I had one, and we went around and saw all kinds of interesting things. There's a museum, and it was just a nice place to visit that was probably different from the life you're used to. And I liked it. Big gift shop, again, touristy, but not touristy like Cabo. It's touristy like a Mexican village trying to be friendly and welcome people to visit it. And I would go back. Now, nothing here is super fancy. You know, you're not going to be having caviar and champagne or anything like that. It's just nice. And if you're down in Baja California, heck, give it a shot. Now, if you're in Cabo, it would actually be a day trip to go up here. It's a couple hours away. It's a couple hours north because, if you know the geography, there ain't no south of Cabo. That's not ocean. But, you basically go up the peninsula, and then you can't help but see it. I like it. I think you should go if you're in the area and you're looking for that kind of thing. So I'll have a link in the show notes to the address for the Hotel California. But if you're ever in Baja and you're just kind of sick of Cabo, this is another option. Resource recommendation. Well, given the chaos of tariffs, we have all these warnings of crazy price. Who the heck knows? But what that means is that if you're looking for a van, you need to expand your options. And I like RVTrader.com for people looking for built-out vans, and I like TruckTrader.com for people looking for unbuilt-out vans. But there's another resource that I think is probably a good starting place, and that is VanLifeTrader.com. That's T-R-A-D-E-R, Trader. And it is not as big as these other sites, but it's hyper-focused. When I looked on there just now, there are 417 or so vans for sale, and they're all camper vans. I mean, these are the vans that we talk about on this show, and there was a nice range. I mean, there's one here that's super fancy. It's $140,000. Oh, here's another one. It's $150,000. You can spend a lot of money here, but I saw a lot of well-built-out Econolines, like 2002 Econolines for under 10. And if you don't have all that much money, but you can afford 10,000 bucks for a van, that's not a bad choice, really. There are Econolines, as long as they're not rusting, you can keep them running forever. You just keep replacing parts, and the parts are easy to get. And then they're all in between. So this is a good place to start. It's a good place to look and get an idea of what's out there and what pricing is. And then if you don't find what you want here, you're at least a little bit more informed for going to other places like RV Trader or whatever. So again, it's vanlifetrader.com. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff on there too. There's help for building a van and resources and stuff. It's actually a good site to bookmark. So give it a look. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 249. Sorry, I'm a little bit late. If you need to get a hold of me, I'm at jeff@builttogo.com. And at builttogo.com, you'll find links to all the other things that we do here. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. And until next time, remember the words of Hal's favorite Greek poet, Anonymous. Be yourself. Everyone else is already taken.